Hi, I'm Ted Price from Insomniac Games, and on today's episode of the AIAS Game Maker's Notebook, we've got one of my favorite people in the industry, Tim Schafer. As many of you know, Tim has been in the industry for a long time, and today he dives deep into topics that I know are going to be of great interest to developers and non-developers alike. We talk about how Double Fine brainstorms on brand new IP. We talk about humor in games and how important that is to Double Fine's culture. We talk about celebrity in and out of the games industry. And we also talk about crowdfunding and new avenues to crowdfunding like Fig. And finally, we talk about Double Fine's new publishing efforts and how that's changing the indie landscape.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Tim, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, it's funny, when I talk to people about the podcast, they always ask, when's Tim coming on?
Because he's always on talking about himself everywhere.
No.
It's hard to keep Tim away from a mic, is what they're saying.
Well, that's a good thing. That's a great thing. And the fact that you are very open with your fans and with the industry about how you guys do things at Double Fine is unique.
We try to pull back the curtain a little bit. I think a lot of it comes from when I was 15 or so, and I wrote Analog Magazine, which is this magazine for people who had Atari 800 computers, 400. Wait, were you an Atari person, Apple or Commodore?
Apple.
Yeah, see, this. Down deep, there's a DNA that you don't want to push on that too far because you'll crack the whole industry into three parts.
Well, I wanted an Atari 800. You know what? The marketing was so good. Yeah. And it was just that my dad figured an Apple II was going to be better.
They're all good. They're all the same processor. That's the lesson in the end. It's all 6502.
It's true. I never thought about that. But you were an Atari 800 guy.
And I wrote a letter to Analog Magazine, and I was like, how did you get into the games industry? And I never heard back anything. They never wrote me back, and I was like, someday. I gave up on that dream right then. I was like, I guess you can't do it. And a friend of mine was like, let's start our own game company. I was like, people like us can't do it. It's like people who are much smarter than us and robots and scientists and stuff do games. And little did I know, at that age, probably like not long after that, Mark Cerny was probably already making Marble Madness or something. Young people were making games, and it was people just like us. And so I wanted to show that people who are making games are not some other species. They're not some other level of intelligence. They're just a different. They're just people who tried it, and they had some good luck along the way. But they did. They did the first step of just trying it.
And that's what you did.
I did get really lucky. I mean, I was in my career center at Berkeley, going, what am I going to do with my life? I had no idea. What was I going to do? And I get a database programming job because I'd studied computer science. And I saw, we want writers who can program and programmers who can write at Lucasfilm. And I was like, that sounds great.
I didn't know you were a database programmer. That's actually what I was doing out of college too. So
all the jobs back then, in the same way now, they're all like web development or so, or who knows where they are now. But back then, people just the job anyone could get were like database programming.
Yeah. What did you use?
All kinds of proprietary weird things.
That's funny because I did too. I used Foxbase because that's sort of what existed. I mean, it was one of those things that existed and had its own language. And
I think Eric Wolpaw used that, and he actually used it to do dialogue for Psychonauts with that.
Really?
Okay. I to manage, because we weren't managing our dialogue good enough for him, so he used that tool. But yeah, proprietary database languages. I can't remember any of their names, but like college radio station helped them organize their database, and I worked at my hometown of Sonoma had a computer store, and I went in the back room, helped him with his database stuff. And I was doing that. I'm not saying I was very good at it, but that's what I was studying computer science. But on the side, I was really getting into my outside of my major classes, like anthropology. I had a folklore class that was amazing, where we just studied folklore all around the world, everything from like myths and legends to like jump rope rhymes and, just riddles and puzzles and toys and things, folk art from all around the world. And we studied the Day of the Dead. And it started my interest in like stories from, cultures that had been told throughout generations without any sort of marketing campaign, and just and also my English classes exposed me to got me to read things like Thomas Pynchon, like Crying a Lot 49, and stuff that just made me really inspired about writing. And I got into creative writing. I had a creative writing classes and in a writing group. And I started to get more like equally interested in that in computer science. And I didn't know where this was going to lead to. And then I saw a job description that had described what I'd been preparing for without realizing it, which was to be a scumlet at LucasArts.
A scumlet.
That's what they called him, scumlet, just to make really? Sure we didn't get too high and mighty. They
no, there must have been some other origin of that name.
It's well, the language is called scum.
Right.
Script creation utility for Maniac Mansion that okay. Ron Gilbert had made for Maniac Mansion. And then their vision was to have these like directors, like Ron and David and Noah Falstein would be these directors of these interactive films that they were making there. And they would have scumlets come in and do all the kind of grunt work. We're like assistant directors who would... do programming and then fill in dialogue and stuff.
Did you embrace that, being a scumlet?
Yeah, can you imagine, like, you're just out of college, you have no idea what you're going to do with your life. All of a sudden, next day, you're working at Skywalker Ranch. There's, like, a bunch of famous people walking around because Sky Sound is there. So, yeah. Like, Jack Nicholson was there and Robert Redford was there. We're in the house of Star Wars. You know, we got to it was beautiful. If you've ever been to the ranch, it's beautiful. We should try and break in there someday. It's really fun. like this, you know, lots of he's really into architecture. It's got this backstory George made about a sea captain who is, you know, his daughter liked Art Deco. And so there's all these parts of the house that are made in different styles from this backstory that it was. So anyway, dream job. And I knew it was a dream job. And this is incredible. This is so incredible. This is crazy. This is going to, and then they, it was a little bit too good to be true because they did kick us all off the ranch eventually because they, all these nerds were like ordering pizzas late at night and doing all these things that they like, this is not, you can't have pizza delivery trucks coming here at midnight. Security guys don't like it. And we were getting too big also.
Really? So was there also an age difference? Were you the young, just out of college group versus the sort of old crusty, had been in the movie industry forever?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of an in-between time. It was right after Last Crusade and Willow, and then it's kind of a downtime where there wasn't a lot of George-run properties being released before episode one. So we're in that kind of valley of the things. And so there's mostly like lawyers and accountants and stuff. That's how we described them. Ah, suits over there in that other building. And then Skywalker Sam was doing sound for and editing and stuff. And we did. We were younger and we were all excited and doing. We're making Monkey Island. We're like Secret of Monkey Island, the first one, surrounded by this. Our composer Michael Land said it's a little intimidating to try and make a small work of art where you're surrounded by this giant work of art that someone else has made. And so when we left the ranch, we went to it was called the Kerner Complex, which is where Industrial Light and Magic actually was in the Canal District of San Rafael. And that was cool too, though, because these people were making movies. These people were like blowing, it's still when they were doing practical effects. So they were blowing up airplanes on strings and like they're doing Hunt for Red October and they had a warehouse full of this, like, turns out to be totally poisonous, but like mineral water fog in the okay. air that they had giant submarine miniatures moving through, you know, and they're still doing a lot of cool practical effects over there. And so it was fun to be next to all these things. Like we were next to we knew the guys who were like in the basement, like we're going to pitch Spielberg on CG for this dinosaur movie he's making. I was like, CG, it's going to be all pixelated. It's not going to work. No one's going to buy five. And then, you know, so it was fun to be near that kind of creative explosion as well.
So was there a lot of or any interaction between sort of the movie side and the game side?
Only like socially, like we'd get to go to their screenings. We'd talk to them. We, you know, there, but there was always, we're like, well, can't we share models? Like you guys, the first, you know, like the early like TIE Fighter models that were made, I think were made in the games division and probably were like ILM had their own and we were trying to exchange that kind of stuff, but it was always difficult because that stuff was locked down a lot. So yeah. I think that got to be more and more done after I left later. Maybe I was the problem, but.
Well, I mean, initially was there the hope that some of the properties you were building would eventually make it into movies?
Yeah, I don't know how much I can say about that, but there was an effort to do that.
Okay.
There's work done on it.
Okay.
And there's always, other people will tell the stories of there was some work on a Monkey Island. There are storyboards and stuff that were made that eventually made it into the movie that eventually got made. That was Pirates of the Caribbean. And there's different people have versions of that story. And if you watch the movies, you can kind of, that's funny that he's sailing that coffin around. That's weird that voodoo hut looks just like our voodoo hut. That's funny. So wow. It worked out in the end.
That, you know, it's fascinating that you relate that, because Insomniac experience was very similar. When after the first year, we moved up to Los Angeles and we were on the lot at Universal Studios, and we were in a bungalow surrounded by all of these movie folks. And so we would eat at the cafeteria every day and see people like Steve Martin walking around, or people taking golf carts through the studios. And we were working right next to Naughty Dog as well, because they also were in the same bungalow we were. But we didn't have any air conditioning. We had the sort of the really low rent spots where everybody else had the nice places. So
that's a funny similar story.
And the interesting thing is too, the Universal, who was our first publisher, used to say, yeah, we're gonna take your properties and we're gonna turn them into TV shows and movies. And obviously that never happened. But
well, eventually, Ratchet and Clank.
That is true. You're right. You're right. I'm sorry. That is correct.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, it's that whole movie games intersection way back then for you was is pretty unique.
Yeah, and I think nowadays there's probably a lot more. There's things going on like OKKO, which I think Cappy is doing with Cartoon Network, where they're actually kind of co-making that IP together. So I think it's just like there was a generation that needed to go through of where you have people now on both sides who understand each other.
Right.
You know, and in the old days, it was kind of like games. I don't know. We're not going to make a movie about Pac-Man.
Well, right. And I think that probably reflects society's view of games, too. It's just there's this acceptance that has sort of grown over the years. But I remember when we were both starting, it was difficult to tell people that you made games for a living. When I went out to parties with friends and they would ask what I did, it was usually I'd get those weird looks when I said,
and they'd be like, oh, games. Pac-Man. They really wouldn't. That's the first thing anyone would bring up. Is like, I really liked Space Affairs Pac-Man. I haven't played much since then. there's some more since then. Yeah.
So after LucasArts, what was the main inspiration for Double Fine? What was the thing that helped you just take a dive off of that?
Take a dive financially. I just made Grim Fandango, and we had our own little kind of company within a company. And I felt like I really like the company overall. LucasArts is getting bigger, and I really like the small feeling of our small team. And I would like to just have that be the whole company, and not, you know, they're definitely advantages to being in a big company. I feel like we've been there for 10 years. I've been there for 10 years. And I was like, I feel like it's time to start our own thing. And also we were really dumb, really dumb. We didn't know what we were doing. And some friends of ours had left to start other game companies. I had that kind of feeling of like, oh, I thought it was different people than me who started companies. I thought it was smarter people. But these guys are, I don't know if I am smarter than them, but I'm somewhere in that neighborhood. And I'm watching them do it. It's like, oh, you just have to do certain steps. You call a lawyer, you do a couple of things, and then you have a company. It's not this like, it kind of pulled back a curtain for me about the world where you go through life a lot hoping to do a good job at things so that nice things are provided to you. Like, I'll do good in school and I'll get an A. You know, I will do good at my job and I'll get a raise. And then all of a sudden when you start your own company, you're like, or I could just make things happen for myself. You know, like I can create this company, and all of a sudden people start acting like that's the thing. And now people are trying to do a good job, so I will give them a raise. And this is weird. This is a whole, and you realize just how many things are, there's more available to you in life than you realize, at least someone who had been lucky enough like me to be prepared for that kind of thing. And not know fully how far of a cliff I was jumping off of either. I was like pretty naive.
Well, I think we all were. I mean, none of us knew what we didn't know, right? That was the blessing and the curse of getting started, especially back when there wasn't really much of an internet and nobody to call to ask questions of.
Oh, those are golden days.
Right? We can make mistakes in a vacuum and nobody would actually see them.
I mean, I guess making a game is similar in that you, if you knew all the hardships you're going to go through by the end of it, if you knew them all at the beginning, you probably either wouldn't have started it or no one would have let you, given you the money to do it. Because they're like these impossible creations that are miracles when they get made. And you deal with all these problems as they come up. But you always think it's going to be easier, and that's probably what makes them happen.
Do you still feel like it's that when you're starting a new IP, when you're brainstorming on something, you decide, okay, we're going to make this game, that it's still that sort of fertile field where, hey, I'm not going to worry about the problems, we're just going to move ahead? Or do you find yourself as you get older thinking about all of the roadblocks that you know are going to show up?
Well, I think it's always really important in anything creative to be really good at compartmentalizing. You know, and do you ever go to that one of the early GDCs, the keynote speaker was actually a motivational creative speaker, and I forget his name, Van He made the creative whack pack anyway. And he did this. At first, I thought it was really silly because he was putting on these wacky hats. And he's like, now I'm going to put on my artist hat and my explorer hat and my warrior hat. And he broke it all up into, you know, you're the explorer. You're just going off into distant areas. You don't care where you go, just finding stuff, finding ideas. And then there's the artist who uses their craft to actually try and make it into something. And then there's the judge who's really self-critical and cuts out the stuff and edits. And then there's the warrior that goes and fights to make it happen. And but afterwards, I was like, I totally... That has been something I've been doing all these years and realized that I got from that, which is that you do separate yourself out in these different functions. And it's really important when you're doing your brainstorming to not think about if that's a bad idea or not worry. I think it's really hard to get the team, even today. I'm like, you guys, we can't worry in this meeting. We can't say no. We can't. We just have to, everyone has to be yes anding and like just go, go, go. And then we'll have another meeting where we actually try to, can we actually make any of those crazy ideas happen? And then we'll have another meeting where we like, talk about what's actually not good and, you know, cut it out. And then you have to fight and fight and fight to make them happen.
How do you prepare everybody for those brainstorming sessions? Do you actually say, hey, go read this Pixar book where it's about yes and, or do you say, this is what I expect? Or do you just assume that everybody knows this is how brainstorming works at Double Fine?
I mean, we do talk about it. I think there's a sign on one of our conference rooms that said no bad ideas in brainstorming.
Okay. That's
and
great.
We do, you know, we try to do like fun field trips to see movies and stuff and prepare and just, I cleared a Slack channel called Psychonautical where we talk about, for one thing, I was trying to get everyone to say Psychonautical instead of Psychonazi, which sounds bad, but also like just sharing like surreal images that seem like something you would see in Psychonauts and just, cause it's gotta be a place to just share that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you have to take the next step of like, okay, can we actually put that into the game? Does that have meaning in a game sense? And push that through. But we definitely I try and talk and sometimes I think I don't do it enough, but like talk about how we in this meeting we'll stop people from worrying. Like because it's easy to be like, oh, if we do, we're gonna have to add a character and that's, I don't know if we can share that rig. And it's like, stop. let's come up with all the ideas and see if we like them before we decide whether they're worth fighting for or worth paying the money for and all that stuff.
How do you know when there are enough people who like the idea to move ahead with it? Is that a gut thing or is it where do you actually have people chiming in saying, I like it, I don't like it?
Yeah, I mean, it's different in every situation. Like if I'm trying to help another level team brainstorm for their level, we're trying to make everyone feel great about it, feel good about the level. And there's different things that like maybe I'm more of the, like if I'm writing or something where I just have to make myself happy and then I see if everyone likes it and tough luck, it's my scene. But when it's, you know, in some situations you're just trying to get a level done. Some situations you're trying to build capacity in a team that you know has to go it alone, you know, sometimes you're just trying to not do it for them because you need them to be able to do it when you're not around. And so different meetings call for different tactics.
Do you feel like you have such a diverse array of people at Double Fine that you have to take sort of a different approach for each of the teams?
Yeah, we have very experienced level designers. We have more junior level designers.
Okay.
And I think it's good to have a mix. You know, a lot of, you know, senior people don't want you to do their job for them. They want ownership and they want autonomy. And then some more junior people get really scared when they're given too much, you know, to run with.
So once you've decided on it, well, actually I want to take a couple steps back because you were talking about Psychonauts and how you guys come up with ideas. I think it's fantastic that you go to movies and suggest different sort of pop culture references for Psychonauts. But what about just the generation of brand new IP? I mean, you've done Amnesia Fortnite, which was, I think, a brilliant approach
it's
to it.
It's a lot of fun, yeah.
And has that sort of become the way that you guys come up with new IP from here on out?
And it has a lot of it. Some of them, like we have experienced people like Lee Petty who ran, he did Amnesia Fortnite where he came up with stacking and he made the game Stacking and then Headlander. And after that, he has established himself enough as a project leader that we just ask him what he'd like to do next. And he does like a little mini game jam sometimes of his own. He gets a small team and does that. And he still can participate in Amnesia Fortnite if he wants. But a lot of our ideas, I feel like a lot of our, is it all of our new IP has been coming from Amnesia Fortnite pretty much. Yeah.
And how do you, this is a question that comes up in Insomniac a lot is when you, how do you make sure that you have the time and to actually do that brainstorming when you've got you, and I know most developers probably have multiple games in production and there are a lot of demands on everybody's time. Mm-hmm. Do you have a specific rule that you use for how we allocate time for brainstorming, or is it just sort of by feel?
Well, I think the important thing, I mean, it's expensive. You know, it's you're funding that 2 weeks of your whatever your burn rate is for your whole studio, which is a lot of money. And so we knew it was like a survival thing for us in a way. Like, so it did save us when we thought we were going to do Brutal Legend 2 and we were working on it, and then it got kind of nixed. And we're like, well, we have four demos from our Brainstead 2 and Ninja Fortnites, and that those is how we saved the company. So it is a survival thing for us. So for us, we know it's worth the money. It has other softer benefits of just, you know, inspiring the team. Yeah. I mean, those are real benefits, but they're harder to show the money, you know, but they are super important. And so we actually just make it a hard and fast rule that the company stops completely and everybody has to do it. A couple times people will be let to slip because they're working on something that's shipping or something. But I mean, everyone's shipping. Everyone's busy. No one has time for it. And that's the thing. We're like, you guys, Ninja Fortnite, it's not fair. It's not convenient. It's just everyone has to stop the company. And we do this. This is what we're doing for 2 weeks. It's completely disruptive. And that's how we made it work for us. Yeah.
Did you have people who are very vocally against it?
Yeah, there's some people who are like, what are we doing this for? Like, we have to get Brutal Legend done. You know, we're in the middle of Brutal Legend.
And,
Taking 2 weeks out of your schedule and stuff. But most people were super excited. They're like, this is amazing. Like, we get to make a game in 2 weeks and we get to do it with all the resources and assets we have at a big company. Like, not a big company, but like our Double Fine size company. It's, you know, instead of making an indie game where you're all by yourself and you have like 12 other people who are really good at what they do. And so it's a really fun break. I think most people really like it.
I think that's sort of a dream for most developers if you have the opportunity and the willpower to go ahead and do it. And one more question about this because it just fascinates me, the culture aspect. In terms of forming teams, how did that work? Was it sort of like picking captains and they would pick their team, or did they just naturally coalesce?
We did the first way. The first time I picked the captains, the team leaders, and then they requested people. And then we let everyone in the company request what project to be on. And then I put together a big chart and we gave points for that. So what you finally ended up with was a team that was mostly who the team leader asked for, taking in consideration where people wanted to work, because some people favored different. And the vision in the beginning of it was, this is really a test of project leaders for me. And I wanted to have kind of replicate everything they would go through running a project, specifically at Double Fine. So, you know, part of it is making a project that would appeal to people and people would ask to work on it. You know, I think that's one of the things that people don't talk about a lot, but like, if you want to do a game that's like, it's going to be a dirge, or it sounds like if you did a game just for the money, like, we're going to be it's all about loot boxes and it's all about a bunch of things that sound like a commercial money grab, right? Yeah. If you pitch that thing at Double Fine, even though it might make a ton of money, people would be like, that's not what we're here for. We're not here to make that kind of game. We're here to make a game that creatively inspires us. So if you were to pitch that in Ninja Fortnite, a lot of people would be like, I don't want to work on that. And that should be reflected in a way, because I think that's part of your choice when you're coming up with a game to make, is like, part of your, like, what will be commercially successful? What inspires me creatively? What will make everyone gather around and want to help me make this thing? Because that's part of it. Yeah, because Brutal Legend was I was a little scared of making it because it was so different than Psychonauts. And but it had so many meeting things for everyone to latch onto. Like, the programmers were like, I get to write squad mechanics and I get to do pathfinding and all these crazy rendering techniques. And the designers were like, we got to think about all these. And the art was, you know, it had a lot of opportunities for a lot of people to do a lot of crazy things. So I was like, in that case, I had accidentally come up with a thing that drew people to it. Like Tom Sawyer's fence, you know, when you got all those people to paint the fence for him, it's like, yeah, that's a trick. You have to just somehow get a fence that everyone wants to come help you paint. That's a bad metaphor.
I love it. it actually reminds me of when I was 12, my parents decided for my 12th birthday, it would be really cool if all of my friends could come over and paint our big fence. Because we had a big fence that was always getting knocked down by cars. Yeah. Drunk drivers would run off the road and knock it down. I was so
this is like a safe yard to play in.
I was so embarrassed by it, and all my friends gave me a hard time for the next 10 years. So that's why I like that metaphor, because it reminds me of my childhood.
Oh,
sorry,
man, that is such a CEO thing to do. You know, it'd be great if you guys all. This is what I want for my birthday. I want you guys to paint that fence.
Yeah, I hope my parents aren't listening to this. They'll kill me. So I definitely want to talk about the tone. Of all the IP you guys create and how, because you mentioned that what you want is something that's commercially viable, but also something the team's passionate about, right? And I think anybody who's a fan of your games, so many people out there understand that humor has been sort of a key component of everything you've done. Mm. So is that Is that just who Double Fine is? Is that who you are? Is that what attracts people to Double Fine?
Well, I think it is about the people. Like, there are a lot of funny people at the company, mm-hmm. and if I sit down to write something, I'll tend to gravitate towards humor. I mean, it's what I like. And I think games, you know, the actions you do in games are kind of ridiculous. You know, I mean, Ratchet and Clank, they're funny situations because I don't know how you would handle a player jumping on an NPC's head if you can't deal with comedy, you know?
Right.
And I think it's a big missed opportunity in games, because if you look at mainstream media, movies, like, comedy is such a big part of entertainment in general, but not a big part of games. And it's more and more a part of games, but I think for a long time it's been people think, you know, people want what games are today, or a game where they see like some sort of hyper-violent shooter in the 90s, and they'd be like, well, that's what they want, you know. But people want a whole bunch of different things, yeah. You know, and I think comedy is, they're being underserved.
Do you have internal debates, though, about how much humor should be in the games, if it's sort of the end goal to make people laugh or have lightened their lives in some way?
I mean, I think it's just a more of an instinct for the person doing the writing is for that game. You know, Iron Brigade still had a lot of funny parts in it. The priority of that game was different. You know, it was like, we want to make a solid mechanical game, tower defense, match shooter. And it's just they need some help with the writing, and I did it. And I was like, well, it's pretty funny in a way to think about what makes this whole crazy world happen.
Yeah.
You know,
well, it was, and I everything I've played from Double Fine has always had that thread, mm-hmm. that always not, let's not take ourselves too seriously. Even stacking. I thought my kids,
stacking is super silly.
Yeah. I mean, well, I say even that because when I looked at the art, yeah. right, it presented itself in a very different way, even though, yes, it's
about Russian child labor,
the Russian dolls. Yeah. And it had sort of the artistic serious overtones, even though you were using the Russian dolls, which was kind of a crazy conceit. Mm-hmm. But it was humorous, and that's for me and my kids. Everything we played of yours, and we play them, we usually play your games together, awesome. has been a great experience because of the humor. Mm-hmm. And we debate the difficulty of having humor that really works in games all the time. And mm-hmm. I believe that most people don't understand how difficult it is to really pull off humor mm-hmm. in games, because it is, you can, it's so easy to fall flat or be corny or campy and not actually match what you're trying to do in the game. Mm-hmm. So I think it comes naturally for you. That's
well, I think if you get a bunch of funny people together, I mean, I think animators are usually pretty funny. They're often gag oriented. You know, most animators that come out of school have been working. Those are some of the memes I like the best, for the weeklies, where you look at a cutscene and you're like, you know what we could do here? What if the character, because there is a lot of that yes ending there. Like, because you're like, let's add a thing where he touches their head a little and that'll be really freaky. And, and they're usually pretty wacky, silly bunch. Oh no! I hope they don't listen to this and be like, "We're wacky and silly." But
but it's true. I think animators and artists in general. I mean, actually, I find that across art development teams, you've got people mm-hmm. who really just love humor and will try to step in and help inject it mm-hmm. where they can.
And I don't know. I don't want to get all high minded about it, but at some point, you do think about, like, I don't have any strong opinions about what games should be, and I don't think anyone should make a rule for game should be this or game should be that. I think it's more a personal choice of, what, as a creative person, like, what do you want to make more of? What do you want to put out in the world? And at some mm-hmm. point you're faced with that. Like, what do I want to just shove out into the world? And I would like to shove out funny jokes. I think the world could use a lot more of that.
So that just reminds me, you're actually wearing a Brutal Legend t-shirt. So
I'm always wearing a Brutal Legend t-shirt. Yeah.
It just makes me think about Brutal Legend and Jack Black. Mm-hmm. And you guys, I remember seeing you both on stage. I think it was at the Spike Awards, a long time ago.
2009.
Yeah.
Which was Flamethrower.
Yes.
I still don't have any eyebrows because of that.
It was awesome, though. And what is it like hanging out with people who are in the sort of the mainstream media doing mm-hmm. comedy? Do you find that you mesh well as a result of your affinity for comedy?
Yeah, we had a great time in the studio. I just saw him last night because we did a table read of Grim Fandango with the original cast. And we had Manny Calavera, Tony Plana, and like the whole cast there. And Jack came and did a lot of the parts that we didn't have. And it was hilarious. And And a lot of those people, you know, people treat them like celebrity. I mean, they are celebrities, but that seems to be the main thing for people. But most of the time when you get a chance to work with someone like that, a well-known musician or well-known actor, you find out they're just creative people and they're probably drama nerds. You know, they kind of grew up just wanting to put on a show. And when you get in that zone where you're just putting on a show together, you know, like talking about what would be funny for this character to say here, and you're working like that, that's what they're all about, is just like anyone else on the team who's just trying to put on a good show. So they're a lot of fun.
That's cool. I'm a huge fan of Jack Black, mostly because he's such a good singer.
He's an amazing singer. He would in between every take on Brutal Legend, he would go into like some Dio song, operatic, you know, just really full on, full voiced. Just love singing all the time.
He's incredible. Well, so talking about a little bit about celebrity, do you ever think about moving into the acting world? I mean, I say this because you're a great host.
Oh, well, thank you.
And it's really fun to see you up on stage and doing your thing, and you're very natural with it. Has anybody ever approached you and said, you know what, we really like you to play a part in
this? I did. You know, it was Messiah from Prepper the Rapper. Messiah was in the audience when I was hosting the awards, and Masura song. And he was in the audience. He goes, will you be in my game Haunt? Which was this Connect game about a haunted house. And I was like, are you sure? And he goes, yeah, because we need a character who's kind of funny, but you don't trust him. Something shady about him. And I was like, that's weird that you got that impression from me. And so I did it. And I think it was fine. But I think they were like, oh, wow, you really can't act. Because I had to do a lot of takes. Like, real acting is not just, you know, like I was, you know, my host was awards. I'm kind of hamming it up and just being myself. And it's a little more like stand up or something, where acting and performance is a lot of just mechanical tricks and tools and skills you need to have. You know, and I was getting tired by the end of the day. And my performance would change with each line as I started getting tired. It's a real hard job, but I don't think I'm particularly good at. I'm a little self-conscious to be an actor. Like I'm a little I'm a little bit more comfortable just being myself and being a big ham. I mean, I do like the attention of being up on stage, and I love it getting people to laugh and stuff. Like it's more like being a smart aleck in history class who gets in trouble with the teacher because he sees a point to place to make a joke, and you know you're not supposed to talk, you just make a joke, and everybody in class laughs. And you're like, yes, that was the best.
Okay, well, so we're not going to see you on the big screen.
I have a lot of respect for real actors who can be like, you want me to feel like what? Okay, hold on. Boom. And all of a sudden they just go into this. There's such a transformation when these people do. And they can be so different. I mean, I've liked everyone we work with, but there's some, you can tell some actors they're not, they create this character and then they're nothing like that. And the things you think you like about them, maybe is that you really like that character they're playing. And then they're just like regular people with different problems. And so it's an amazing skill. Like they know what every muscle of their body's doing.
Yeah.
They know how the tense their voice is. They know how there are those kind of monks who can control their heartbeat and sweat.
That's pretty. So are you directing all the actors in your games? Is that?
We have a voice director, Chris Brown, who's directed a lot of my games. And I go into the studio when we're creating a character and when we're starting out, a game, and I'll talk with actors about how their performance, and I'll explain. I need to explain a lot of the jokes in my script because they're like, oh, okay, this is how this is supposed to be funny, and I'll give the actress some help there, and then she does a lot of it without me.
Do you help with the casting as well? Do you decide who you'd like in the game?
We get like a big casting. We send out a casting package, and she goes through it all and pulls out maybe the top five for each one. Then we listen to both together and we talk about it together.
That's cool. I got to tell you, I really haven't heard much about how casting works in our industry. Mm-hmm. We tend to focus on programming, design, art, audio, the mm-hmm. other side of the audio, and versus working with actors. At least that's not something I hear a lot. What do you think makes it different? What do you think makes a successful collaboration with an actor who is in a game?
Well, to me, it's about recognizing that they're part of the creative team, mm-hmm. you know, and they're helping you create this character, and they're not just like a hired gun who just does what you tell them. I think, you know, like a lot of people, I think you get the best results with all the creative people on your team. If everyone feels like they're part of that putting on a show kind of feeling, you know, and, you know, you treat them like that. Cause they're a big part of it. We share a lot of actors between our games. Yeah. You know, I just was with Jim Ward last night. He was one of Hector Lamont's, and he's also,
Kevin Quirk.
Right. And he has this amazing voice that he goes into, and, you know, who and someone else? Clank.
Dave.
Kane?
Yes, David Kane.
Okay. Yeah. He's like, and we've worked with him a lot of other times. And what was the question we were talking about? Yeah, I feel like you are, some places I think we'll treat those like they're the end of the line and they're supposed to, you know, the creative team's over here and they're just like someone who just reads a script to the mic. And I think it's better when they're involved with figuring out who that character is.
Yeah, I agree. Because we're not the ones who are speaking, right? So it's really difficult to say, hey, be more robotic or be more alien.
I mean, I think you share a goal. You're like, okay, this scene is supposed to be really, is it, are we playing this for last or this is our heartfelt touching scene. And this is the goal. And then they figure out how to get there. And yeah. I think that's how we do it.
That's great. Yeah. I think frankly, we're it's nice to be located in California where we can actually work with actors.
Yeah, we do. We readily. Come down here to do most of our recording. There's some local San Francisco talent, but we mostly come down here and work with the SAG-AFTRA people.
Are you SAG-AFTRA?
Myself personally?
Yeah.
I think I tapped Hartley myself to do that, okay. That part.
Yeah, which I mean, for our listeners, that is the where you get a temporary
a one-shot gig.
Yeah, ability to not violate union rules and be an actor in a game, which is interesting because we in this industry sign agreements with SAG-AFTRA to mm-hmm. only have union actors in our game, or we go non-union, non-SAG-AFTRA. And there's been a lot of controversy over the last couple of years with SAG-AFTRA and how they've sort of railed against the industry at times and demanding royalties on the games, et cetera. So we won't go into that here.
But. No. I do think you have to be careful with your actors and their voices, though. Save all your screaming to the end of the day. There's a lot, like a lot of
well, the rules.
Recordings, I mean, they don't. Some places they had to set those rules up because people, if you just read a script in order, it's like, okay, you're going to get shot like 100 different ways right now. So let's do, and that kind of stuff fries their voice. And
it's amazing, though, what they can do. I mean, I'm always impressed with, I haven't been in the studio for the last decade, but back early, I was used to work with the actors, and I couldn't believe how, as you're pointing out, how versatile they were, and also how much stamina they had. I mean, you can scream if you can scream again and again. There's a technique to it.
But yeah, that was a great thing about working with Rob Halford from Judas Priest.
I'll bet,
because he has an 8-octave range, and he would just do it all day long. And I was like, do you need a rest? He's like, what? No. And I'll give you some evils and some demon yells. And I'll, you know, and he yelled double fine. And it just made my day. And he just belt that stuff out. And his vocal cords, like these two massive biceps. They're just like, he can just do it all day.
What were some of the other rockers that you got to work with that you remember?
Well, the first one was Lemmy, the late, great Lemmy. We were all scared because it was our first rock star. And we're like, some people had worked with him before at Vivendi, who's in the Scarface game. And they're like, look, just get him set up with an ashtray. And we're like, but I can't smoke in the studio. So get him an ashtray and Jack and Coke and Cheez-Its, and then turn the mic on and he'll start talking when he's ready. And it happened just like that. He came in, he made himself a Jack and Coke. He offered me one. He just sat there smoking. We talked about the script, and he tried to be really into that kind of genre of fantasy mixed with magic and science fiction, like Moorcock. He was like, "You're in it, Moorcock." And I got a collection of Roman swords at my house. You want to come over and check them out? And I ended up going to his house to see his Roman sword collection. Wow. Also, so he was really friendly and really nice. And he just did it all in one take. Like most actors, you know, you do 5 takes of every line. He just did it all once, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm pretty fast." And then Ozzy came, and Ozzy Osbourne was there, and he was just a big hand, like a hoot. Like he was just like making jokes the whole time and really funny and lively in the studio. And we had Rob Halford. He was very like, we're about to record and I got a call on my cell phone I didn't recognize. And I was like, hello? And he's like, hello, this is Rob Halford. I just want to call and say I'm going to be 10 minutes late. Like I was for this podcast. But he called 10 minutes late. And I was like, wow, Rob Halford just called me. Tell me he's going to be late. He's so considerate. And so, you would think I would have learned a lesson and called you guys. No. And Lita Ford, who we worked with remotely. And we had a kind of, we didn't get to work with her directly, but we did a over the phone. Still their home studio, but that was a lot of fun.
Were any of them touring at the time that you were making the game?
Well, we worked with Ozzy a couple times. A couple times we had to go to where he was, like London, and record him there.
Cause really?
He was touring. Yeah.
Did you get to go to the a concert while you were
after? There? After we got to go backstage at an Ozzy show.
Oh, great.
And get really close to the Flamethrowers yet again. And, that was really great. And we get to see, we're going to go hopefully backstage of the Tenacious D show that's coming around.
Oh, that must have been fantastic.
Yeah, it's fun. But like deep down, they're all just creative people who all want to put on a show. Yeah. It's the same, like kind of like P.T. Barnum impulse and all those people, you know.
So we're talking about celebrities, but you are a celebrity in this industry, and we're here at E3. And what is it like for you walking around? Do you get recognized pretty readily by people?
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird kind of celebrity. I'm doing air quotes for the people who are not, because you're like kind of like micro famous or like local famous. Like if you're a GDC or E3, you can walk the floor and people will like ask to take selfies and stuff like that. And it seemed, and they're very excited and they're all really nice. It's nice. It's only a pain if you're trying to get somewhere fast. So I usually will walk right behind Greg, and you know, Greg is one of the tallest people in the industry, and I'll be on my phone kind of drafting behind him if we need to get somewhere in a hurry. But otherwise, we'll stop and talk to people, and they're all really nice. And then if you like, I remember walking away from GDC once, and then walking to the train to go home, and you could just kind of feel the fame. Like you feel like a god surrounded by all those people. Then you feel that fame just melt away. And by like a block away from GDC, you're just a schlub. Like, and someone's like yelling at you, and you're like, get out of the way, and you're like, oh, it's gone. And that's fun. I think that's good too, because it keeps you from believing that, you know, taking that too seriously. And because when I was on that stage with Jack and the flamethrowers were going off, it's easy to think like, oh, I'm here because I'm so awesome. But you're like, no, I'm here because I'm at the tip of a rocket fueled by EA's marketing division, right? You know, like they're promoting a game, and I just happen to be at the very front of it, screaming and thinking that I can fly to the moon, but I can't. I'm just, So it's good to keep that perspective on the whole thing.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And I think most of our industry embraces that as well. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see that there really haven't been many of our peers who have really gone out there and said, it's all about me. I need to be on stage. Really, it all comes back to the games and the teams that are making the games every single time.
Yeah.
And that's been, I don't know about you, but for me, that's one of the really nice things about being in games.
Yeah.
Because we don't have to deal with all of that stuff that we see right next door to us in Hollywood, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, after working with a lot of celebrities, I wonder about how that ever happened, because none of them, when you're actually working with them, like I've been saying, they're all really just creative people. And sure. I feel like in some ways they've realized that celebrity status is really just helpful to them, you know, financially. I mean, it helps you get deals and stuff. And
that's a good point. It sounds like I was denigrating Hollywood. That's not my intent.
No, I mean, I always wonder like, why do they, sometimes it seems like they let that kind of perpetuate, like, you know, but they're also kind of trapped. Like you see famous people, like they can't walk somewhere. They, you know, when you see someone being harassed by TMZ, like they're just trying to like, go to the store, you're like, oh, that must suck to like try and walk to the store and have someone yelling at you and asking you questions about your kids' clothing and stuff like that. Well, and
that is, but there, that is the brand though too. It's the brand that one creates in Hollywood. It is about the actors and the folks who are sort of above the line. Whereas in our business, I remember, and you probably remember this a few, I don't know, 15 years ago, there was a push to get game developers out there as celebrities.
Mm-hmm. And well, we were promised that when we started by that EA ad with Bill Budge wearing the bracer, you know, and they were like, you know, someday these programmers or these nerds are going to be viewed as rock stars. And I was like, okay, well, I'm signing up for that.
But it really hasn't come to pass. And I think that has to do with it's just a different place. It's a different approach. And we focus on making the games, I guess. Yeah. That's,
and we're not good looking enough also.
That too. That is absolutely true.
Well, it's kind of like it's run by directors and stuff, and there's not a lot of that glamour associated with it. But and also, you know, going back and doing these things like the Grim thing and you know, remastering old games and just looking back in the games in my career and like the ups and the downs and like just looking at how lucky I was to why was that game successful? It's like, because that cool, crazy group of people that came together and made it at that time. And a lot of them I don't work with anymore. Some of them I do. But how lucky was I that that artist and that musician and that programmer like and that animator all came together to make that incredible thing, you know? And I was lucky enough to be, you know, sometimes I think of myself as like the soup stone. Like, you know, you drop the stone in the soup and then it's okay. You just need to add a little carrots, maybe some potatoes. And then you take the stone out at the end and the whole thing is soup. And I'm like, I was just there to kind of gather all those people together and make this something happen. And then write all the dialogue, like a stone that can write dialogue.
Well, that's an interesting point. And you talked earlier about all the hats, right? So how many hats do you wear these days?
Well, I try to manage my hats because I think it's easy to get pulled into different jobs you don't want, you know, because I've watched friends of mine who were great artists and they kind of they've gone different career paths. So some have gone into like, I just want to be the best artist, like this really in demand concept artist, or I want to be a lead artist. I want to run my own project. Cause one of them said like, cause that's where the money is. And I was like, well, maybe. And maybe he's like, he was an art director and then a project leader. And he's like, yeah, I'm just kind of bummed that I'm not doing art anymore. But I'm trying to get excited about helping other people do great art. And that is a lot of times management is like that. You're no longer the artist, you're the person who facilitates other people doing art, which can be good or bad. It's a whole different skill set. And some people are good at that. There's some people who are good at art and they're terrible at that, you know? But what I think you have to be in touch with was like, what lights your fire every day and the fire in your belly, you know? And like, what makes you happy about going into work? Because if I stopped writing, I think I would, if it's really easy to get pulled into the financial side of Double Fine, because you've got there's a lot of work to do there, signing contracts, getting deals made, worrying about how much money there is to do. And also like, what about what kind of desks we have? There's a lot of things you can't worry about in a company. And I could easily get pulled into that, or I could hire someone smarter than me and do that for me so I can still do the stuff that I like to do, which is write. Because if I stopped doing that and I started doing that other stuff, I would just wake up one morning and be like, why am I going to work today to pick desks out and look at the bank account? I don't like my job anymore, you know? And so when people talk about what it's like to do games for as long as we have, like almost 30 years, you know, part of it is managing your own inspiration and making sure your job is still the hat you want to wear, or hats.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So don't put on that bad hat.
Well, I'm sure at times you do have to look at the financials, right? And I think one of the coolest things that has happened over the last several years is crowdfunding of games. Mm-hmm. And you were at the forefront of that movement with Kickstarter and then with Fig. So where is that today? Because I'm sure a lot of our listeners aren't really thinking about that too often. So you are the expert, you and Justin, right? Yeah. And several others have really been pushing sort of new frontiers in that area.
Yeah, I mean, it changed our company completely. You know, we were just getting into self-publishing and doing it a small ways, you know, with ports and through angel investment. And crowdfunding let us self-publish a whole game by ourselves. And like, wow, you get to keep the money when you self-publish. That's interesting. And we since then has crowdfunded two more games, and it has been great. It creates a great relationship with your fans. They're very much more plugged in, and I think it's even novel. It was a big novelty when it first came out. It was like no one could believe this was actually happening. You know, the Broken Age crowdfunding, when it was hit 1 million and then 2 million and 3 million, is like an event. It felt like this thing. People were like, what's happening to the world? This is crazy. And people want to be part of it. And I feel like that feeling is mostly gone from crowdfunding now. That feeling of like, oh my God, this newsworthy, crazy thing is happening. I mean, every once in a while, there'll be a breakthrough, you know, crowdfunding experience that makes $8 million and everyone pays attention. But I think it's a little more routine. And that's kind of what I was hoping for. Eventually, that it would become more routine and repeatable. Mm-hmm. So you could just keep doing it. It'd be just one of the many options that people have. And we started, when we were doing our crowdfunding, we were like, the only thing I feel guilty about is what if this game's a big hit? What if we make a lot of money off of it? What about the people that made it happen? Like if that was a publisher, they would get money for that, but these backers won't get anything. Is there any way we can share the money with them? And we actually asked Kickstarter about that, and they said they can't, that's illegal because that's investment then, and that's regulated by the SEC. And so we said, okay. And then some of the SEC rules changed, and Justin was really up on that. And so he spun off and started Fig to kind of be there when that change happened. And so we were one of the first crowdfunding campaign. I think we were the first one to take unaccredited investors, which means not rich people who are just investing, you know. And I think that changes things. And I think there's some movement there that's yet to happen. When the first, like when Psychonauts is done, starts making money for the people who backed it, I think people are going to start to see how that could happen. And like, wow, you could, you know, when Brian and Fergus's games come out, and because I feel like those are good investments I made as a backer, yeah. I can like look forward to thinking I'm going to make my money back on those games. And when people start to make money on games, I think it'll get even more excited about crowdfunding. And I think it hasn't. I thought it was going to be funding everything we're doing pretty soon to be like $20 million campaigns. And that hasn't happened yet. But we'll see if once people start getting revenue back, if it starts growing again.
Are we going to see, and by the way, we're talking about Justin Bailey and Fig.
Fig.co.
And he is currently the CEO and founder of the company. And you, he was your COO originally.
He left to found that, and we started Psychonauts 2, funded it on there. And now I'm on their advisory board, me and Brian and Fergus and Alex Rudopoulos and some other people. I keep forgetting who's announced, who's not announced. But
that's a great board.
Yeah, and we need to look at new games and talk about who we should be funding and not. And so it's you know, it's not like it's a few games at a time. You're kind of closely watching them, and it's a little more curated.
And so you've got, I mean, Fig has several big games, including yours, who that are queued up mm-hmm. to be released in the next period, yeah. call it year, couple years.
Yeah.
And things really could change. So what's your hope mm-hmm. for Fig and for the future of funding bigger and bigger games?
I mean, my hope is that we make money for people who back the projects okay. and we get to back bigger and bigger projects, which would mean just our ability to stay independent and make grander and grander experiences for people without going to more onerous sources of money with more sense. Strings attached is where this, you lose your IP and other things.
Do you think that there are also a lot of smaller games that are being funded through yeah. Fig right now? Do you think this is changing the lives of many independent developers?
I mean, it's opened another door that, you know, there's a lot of things in games. A lot of doors have become open to indies, you know, nowadays mostly for the better, but it's created a lot of games. There's definitely a lot of more games out there. But now that you can, you know, download something like Unity or Unreal and make a game without that kind of impediment, you know, of having to write an engine from scratch, and you can distribute it digitally. You can use crowdfunding and social media to do your marketing, you know, and then you can, you know, fund it with crowdfunding. It's just there's just so many opportunities to just come from nowhere and make a great indie game.
Well, you talk to a lot of indies, I mean, yeah. all the time. And do you feel like the numbers are growing and growing, given the abundance of resources that are out there in terms of education, in terms of free tools mm-hmm. you mentioned?
That's right, education.
Yeah, in terms of resources, being able to find people of like mind who can join you in a team. Mm-hmm. Do you think we're seeing an explosion, or is it sort of still limited to those people who are willing to mortgage their house and give up everything in their lives to dive in?
I mean, it definitely is easier if you can live at your parents' house for a yeah. while. But I think it's opened up a lot of doors, and there are a lot more games, and I think that's a problem people discuss a lot more, is the you know, discoverability. There's so many games on Steam, and
yeah.
it's hard to stand out. And that's one of the reasons that, along with some other small indies, Double Fine is doing publishing of other people's games now. Double Fine Presents is what we call our publishing branch, and we look at small games from less experienced studios, because a lot of people were coming to us, especially after our crowdfunding success, and saying, like, will you look at my crowdfunding page? What do you think of our rewards? What do you think of our, and I was like, your video's too long. And I'd be like, yeah. We give them some advice, and then they'd be like, how do I get featured on the Xbox platform? You know, how do I get who do you know at Sony? And we started giving all this advice to people about what we'd learned, because it's been around for a long time. And we don't have like a huge pile of cash we're sitting on to just throw at developers and fund their games, but we do have a lot of experience with those kind of topics. And so we're like, let's just make this an official thing, because these people are taking up, you know, a lot of our time. We should might as well make it part of something we're doing officially. And so Greg is doing a lot of, Greg Rice, our VP of Biz Dev, is doing a lot of the curation of that. He has a good eye for interesting indie games that kind of fit. You know, they don't look like Double Fine games in one way, but they also do. Like, just games that have a lot of personality and charm and heart to them. And they're also being made by people who are, it's a labor of love, and they just really care about what they're doing. But they don't know, you know, how do you go through CERT? You know, what's a TCR and all these things. And we can help them with that. And we have like a release producer that can help them, you know, actually get their game onto the platform, and who to talk to at Apple, and all these little things that make a big difference your first time out.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Are there any that you can talk about that you're excited to see yeah. soon?
Yeah, I mean, we have been working with Bone Loaf on Gang Beasts, which is a big smash hit in the
looks
fighting
fantastic.
World. Yeah, I mean, it's a fighting game, and it still looks like, speaking of humor, like it's the you players make their own humor with that really crazy slapstick.
It looks fantastic. I played it at E3. I think a couple of years ago, there was a demo yeah. in the Sony booth,
yeah.
and it was just, you just laughed. I mean, that was...
It always draws a huge crowd, and yeah. We have a little wrestling ring set up for it, and we're, you know, helping that team continue to release expansions for that.
That's
and
cool.
We're here showing Knights and Bikes, which is Rex Crowell from Tearaway and A Little Big Planet. He's a two-player co-op game about growing up in Cornwall, these two girls growing up in Cornwall, England. beautiful, everything hand painted by Rex himself in his own style. It just looks amazing. And just a two person team, him and Boo Yu.
Okay.
You might know from the old days of Insomniac. Yeah. It's just the two of them. And they're putting that out, and we're showing that here. He's in Into the Pixel. He's got one of his prints out there,
okay,
right outside the door here.
Right on.
We're also talking a lot about kids, which is almost more of an interactive art piece.
Yeah, that looked amazing. It was a really sort of a poignant piece that you have up on your site right now.
Yeah.
And people should go check it out.
Yeah, it's called Kids, and it is on our site. And it's great on the iPad. It just flows really well, and you're just – It there's no words or anything. You just experience it, and it feels like it's about something, and that's a whole different type of thing.
Yep.
And then there's Ooblets. If you've seen Ooblets, yep, which is another two-person team out in New Hampshire, and it's a game that's adorable, like super cute, collecting creatures. It's a little bit like Pokemon, these little Ooblets, but you also farm them. So it's a little bit like Harvest Moon or something, and then you're simulating this town, like a little Animal Crossing type thing. So it's all those things put together in this like friendly little town where you're building and customizing your house and growing your own ooblets, and then they get together and have these dance battles, and you can upgrade your ooblets and buy them little hats and stuff. And it looks like it's really a place you want to kind of hang out in, you know, and stay there.
That's great that Double Fine's doing that. I think that's what this industry needs more of, because there are a lot of people who have great advice who can offer it. And the fact that you're doing more than that and helping create a platform for indies who might not be able to share their visions with the world.
Yeah. And I think it's fun for us to do. It helps us out. It's good. Helps us out as a business, because we get to release or help. We're involved in shipping when we're doing things like Psychonauts 2 right now, and Lee's new project, Secret Project. And so it's going to be a while before we're shipping those. And then we're like, we wouldn't come to this E3 normally, but like we have all these Double Fine Presents titles to show and share. So it just keeps us a little more, keeps us regular, like prunes. That's our slogan for Double Fine Presents. Keeps you regular, like prunes.
I love it. So I got a couple more questions for you. And I know there are a lot of people who want to know what it's like, you know, to be you. And I think it's been awesome that you've explained your background and what it's like to be a Double Fine and your culture. What advice do you usually give people who ask you about getting into the games business and doing what you do?
Huh. Well, I mean, it's changed a lot since the old days. Nowadays you can download an engine and watch a YouTube video, and all of a sudden you're making a game. And so I definitely advise people to just do that.
Okay.
There's a little bit of just like, start making a game, because even though you don't, it's hard to give specific advice, because someone might want to get a job at a big publisher or go indie. But either way, making a game will help, and either help your resume or help you just get starting on a pro. Because if you're interviewing someone and they're like, I've made a bunch of games, I have three games on my website, like that person knows how to finish things or is good at designing or good at whatever skill they're pushing. Just making a game and showing that you can finish a project or showing that you can collaborate with other people, or you know that you all you did was you organized the group that came together and made the game. That if you're hiring a producer or something, that might be someone who you want to look at. And so and I hate to say, like, it just sounds like you're just advising someone to practice if they want to be in a rock band or something like that, but it is great practice. For just starting out indies, I always try to manage their expectations, because I think a lot of them have been working on their first game for like 10 years or something. It's been this hobby and this pet project. It's, to them, it's their one big thing, and they kind of expect it to make a huge splash when they release it. But nowadays, it's really hard to make a splash. It's a lot more about the long haul. You know, you release your game and you try and get as much attention as you can, and that's what we help with our titles, try and like tweet about them and get a lot of exposure to them. But then, like, a lot of people make more money on their first Steam sale than they do on their launch day. And, like, you're going to be, Double Fine now has a back catalog of games that generate revenue for us. And some of them make more money this year than they did the year they launched. And it's like a long, you have several revenue streams coming in from back catalog games, right? And, like, just if you make an indie game, you can't just, like, I've been surprised lately. I've seen a lot of postmortems about indie games that have come out where it's a week after they shipped and like, here's what went wrong and it wasn't very successful and all this stuff. I'm like, how do you know it's not successful yet? You just shipped that thing. Big AAA games are like opening movies that have their weekend is really important, right? But it's not the same with indie games. Like, it's not this opening weekend type thing. It's like they go for a long time before they find their audience sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Fortnite, kids. That was out for a long time until they, I don't know what their magic thing was. Who knows what it was, but they changed something and all of a sudden.
That's excellent advice. And so I'm going to ask a dumb question, but just again, just in case people don't know, if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that? You have 1.2 million followers on Twitter. I mean, I look at those, that number, and I think to myself, I have 1.2% of that.
It's all bots.
It's awesome. But you answer people's questions, you retweet.
I mean, really, people tweeting at me, I will respond to most people if I can think of something to say in 5 seconds. Like if I can think of something to say, if they ask a hard question, I will not answer because I don't have time. But if they ask, they're just friendly, they're nice. If they're rude at all, I block them. Like I've changed a lot with social media and stuff. I used to think you had to engage with everybody, but as soon as someone is like just rude and mean, I'm like, you don't get to talk to me anymore. Because I would have killed when I was a kid to have that, like that letter I wrote to Analog, just to bring this all the way back to the beginning. Like I was trying, if I could have gotten in contact with, the people who made Space Invaders, that would have been amazing. I would have been like, I would have killed for that kind of access. And people have that access now and they abuse it by just being jerks. Like you don't get it anymore. So that's how I've changed.
But they can get you in terms of your Twitter address.
I mean, if you're an indie game maker who wants to talk to us about publishing your game, you can mail indies@DoubleFine. Indies@DoubleFine, PR stuff. They mail PR@DoubleFine. Okay. And that's for that kind of business inquiry stuff. But usually if people tweet at me, I'll tweet back.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's a great show.
Cool.
Awesome. We're shaking hands right now. You guys can't. Yes. Can you hear it?
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.